Karin Vistava is teaching in the Department of Technology and Society Studies at the Maastricht University. She's the author of Mechanical Sound, Technology, Culture, and Public Programs of Noise in the 20th Century. She's also the co-author of Sound and Safe, A History of Listening Behind the Wheel, which I believe came out this year from Oxford University Press. She has also edited several books, including Sound Souvenirs, the Oxford Handbook of Sound Studies, and Soundscapes of the Urban Past. Her talk today is titled Hearing and Seeing Voices, Speaker Identification at the Stasi. Please welcome Karin Voss.
Thank you, Yuriko. Also, thanks to Jonathan and Nicholas, of course, for bringing us together, the people from Visual and Sound Studies. I would say in one of the most genuinely sensory realms of academia, the conference. We often say, you know, that, you know, finally we can see each other, we can hear each other, we can touch each other, smell, taste. The dinners, right? That's one. Well, on the screen, you see a photo of the former desk of Erich Mielke. He was head of the Ministry of State Security in the German Democratic Republic between 1957 and 1989. And the two telephones and the control panel visualize one of the Stasi's key activities, and that was monitoring on its own population through eavesdropping and wiretapping. Well, the department officially in charge of the activities within the Stasi was Abteilung 26, Department 26, and on the slide you see the numbers expressing the stunning capacity of the Stasi for wiretapping and eavesdropping, and some of these numbers you have already read probably in my abstract. It's well known that the Stasi had hidden microphones in pens, in watches, in cigarette boxes, in telephone booths, in interpreters' booths, in offices, in private apartments, in hotels, and it was quite a time-consuming affair. For instance, only to keep all the equipment running, they had to inspect the batteries, they had to change the tapes, choose the speeds of of recording, and also they had to make sure that there wouldn't be too much vibration to make the recordings. At the moment, the Stasi archive has 27,000 tapes left with 28,000 hours of recorded sound. But they did not always know. The Stasi did not always know what they had recorded and to whom they were listening. And the photo on the screen shows our original Stasi tapes. Most of the photos in my presentations are made either by others or by me of materials from the Stasi archive or from the Stasi museum. And the presentation itself is based on the Stasi archives themselves. Many years ago, I sent a letter to the Stasi archives asking for access, asking about information about the speaker identification program. I knew or suspected that a program like that would be there. For 1.5 years, I heard nothing, and then one day, a big box arrived, and the big box had thousands of copies of the documents from the Stasi. This is important to know because I didn't collect these documents themselves. They were sent to me. It had never ever happened to me before. It's quite an experience for an historian, but it's important to know that I did collect the archival material myself. Well, I didn't select. They have now promised me access, so I will very soon also have access to both the tapes and more of the documents. Now, the Stasi was so much interested in knowing about, you know, who the voices and the sounds were they were recorded, because they were concerned about two things in particular. Anonymous phone calls, so-called threatening phone calls from class enemies to authorities like the police, ministries, the Stasi itself, or private persons, with all kinds of threats bomb threats, death threats, or entirely manufactured calamity reports, and phone calls about what the Stasi called smear campaigns against state ideology. And the other issue that had the highest interest were the sounds of espionage and conspiracy, the right column. Because the Stasi blocked so many spaces with secret microphones, they had many sort of occasional recordings, and they also recorded the sounds of burglaries into government offices or what they called unauthorized access to policy files. And the sounds they were interested in were the sounds of the camera shutter clicks, cars arriving and leaving, car doors opening and closing, etc. Because these sounds could inform them on the type of camera used, the number of pages copied, the position of the camera, the type of the car, the direction from which cars came and went, and the number of people involved. And for that reason, they started a research program on sound by collaborating with the Russian KGB and the Humboldt University. It started in 1966, and the real program started in 1969. And what they wanted is to improve the quality of the recordings. That was the idea behind the sound program, so improve the quality of the recordings by improving the signal-to-noise ratio, establishing the authenticity of recordings, and identifying the sounds in the voices. These were the questions I had about that program. So how exactly did Stasi employees dissect the sounds they were interested in? And here the Stasi is represented by still from the movie The Lives of Others. This is the Stasi agent that listens to a couple in an apartment constantly. So how did the Stasi employees dissect the sounds, and how did listening become a legitimate way of knowing in this context? And legitimate, of course, refers to the way in which the Stasi itself legitimized what it did, and in that the notion of scientific was crucial, as has so often been the case in many totalitarian bureaucratic systems. And it's for this reason that I want to share something completely different. This is a drawing by Salvador Dali, bureaucrat and gramophone. It's from 1933. Jonathan, did you know this one? Okay, great. I hope that you would not know this. And I came across that in an art collection, the Scharf-Gerstenberg collection in Berlin. I had never seen it before. And I have added it here not only because it pictures sounds and thus serves this conference, but also because it so vividly pictures the dissection of sound in a bureaucratic context, and also expressing its violent nature. Even though, because this is from 1933, not from the 60s I'm talking about, this probably refers to art censorship. It may also refer to the troubled relationship between Dali and his father. His father was a bureaucrat, and he has made more pictures about bureaucrats, in which his father has the main role. But I thought for this theme and also for this conference, I thought that this was a very nice picture. And it certainly serves my claims for today, because what I want to say about the Stasi's ways of knowing is that this largely followed trends in international audio forensics and in sonic skills in the sciences, that it hesitated between forms of embodied knowledge and mobile knowledge, and that this expressed its totalitarian embedding. And I'll explain later what I mean by embodied and mobile forms of knowledge. And this hesitation proved daunting both to the people under surveillance, and in the end also to the Stasi itself. It was even detrimental to the Stasi itself. Now, the Stasi also established its program on speaker identification because it was initially highly interested in the usefulness of voice prints, or sonograms of speech, made with the help of a spectrograph. And the idea was that the sonograms visualized the pitch of a voice in the vertical axis and its loudness through the shades of gray over time and time is represented in the horizontal plane in a way that was unique for an individual speaker, like fingerprints are unique for individuals. And here you see six voice prints of the word you. It's uttered by five male speakers, and two of of the pictures are of a you by one and the same person. And this was published in 1962 by Lawrence Kerstad in Nature. And Lawrence Kerstad was a firm believer in this voice print idea and hoped to exploit it commercially. And when I showed these pictures in Harvard, one of the problems was I did not immediately see which of these pictures matches, and I remember that Jonathan didn't know either in Harvard, and this is always nice for students to know. Jonathan didn't know. And, you know, I had difficulty, but the right answer is that A, you know, the upper left and the right, you know, down at the bottom, at the right, are the ones that actually match. So Lawrence Kerstad really believed in it, but internationally there was a lot of critique. So the usefulness of this kind of sonograms for speaker identification was very contested. One of the arguments was that the inter-speaker variation was considered too high. There was a risk of voice mimicry, so you could sort of, you know, mimic someone else's voice. And also there might be the risk of conflation of the voices of people from the same peer group, for instance, groups of criminals. But the society wasn't convinced either. But for very specific GDR-related reasons. The voices on their recordings were often deliberately distorted. Many recordings were of insufficient quality. And again, the same speakers might not always use the same kind of voice or the same kind of words with similar emotions. And the SASI was especially worried about differences across time, because their idea was, you know, that they might actually needed to identify someone years after a particular act. So this was very specific for them, that they also had their doubts about the usefulness of mechanical spectrograms, even though they were initially interested, and also even though they did use it. But actually, that for them it was just an add-on. They were specifically interested in oral analysis and manual oral analysis. That was their alternative, analysis by ear instead of mechanical visual analysis. The Stasi sincerely believed in the refined capacities of the expert ear. So recorded voices should be carefully analyzed on the basis of their pitch, volume, tempo, rhythm, sound color, speech style, tension, fluency, impediments, accents, dialects, articulation, etc. So instead of visual inspection, they believed in oral dissection in order to identify speakers. At the same time, however, and this is very important, the oral analysis still followed the logics of the visual fingerprint analysis in its focus on finding a match between new unidentified material and archived identified material. And it's important to underline this. It's not self-evident. In theory, the Stasi, I mean, they were powerful enough, could have just sent out their agents and unofficial collaborators, the inoffizielle Mitarbeiter, citizens working for the Stasi as ear witnesses, trying to recognize the voices on tape. I mean, the Stasi was also a firm believer in the notion of an ear witness. But in contrast, it focused on finding matches through a detailed description of various auditory components of voices, which gave the analysis, and this is very important, which gave the analysis a scientific and juridical legitimation, and the idea was, of course, that in the future it would make identification very easy. But what did it require? The logics of finding a match required building an archive of recorded voices, which they did. By 1988, they had over 3,000 recorded voices in a stream archive or Sprecher archive or voice databank. And the idea was that one had to compare so-called Tatmaterialen and Vergleichsmaterialen. Tatmaterial was the incoming material, so the newly recorded material, and the Vergleichsmaterial were the archived voices in the databank, which you had to compare for oral analysis. Now, the next slide I want to show you is an example of a Tatmaterial. What you will see is the transcript in English so that you can follow it, but you will hear the quote in German. However, I have to explain how we have done this. I had only a transcription, so I didn't have the original recording. But to get an idea of it, I asked two German colleagues to read and record the original German text using the description of the qualities of the voice for how to read it. So they read the report made by the Stasi, which made this detailed description of what kind of voice it was. And I showed them the quote and that description and to see what they made out of it. And it was quite different from my mental oral image of that particular voice, which already shows how difficult it is. And where Tama will help me with it so that I don't mess up the... This is the slide, and there's the recording. You can just... Yeah, great.
Bitte lassen Sie mich ausreden. Und jetzt rede ich, nicht Sie. Sie haben einen guten Mann von uns geschnappt. Und wenn Sie sich noch einmal in der Gegend des Kurfürstendamms blicken lassen, mit einem I-Zeichen, das heißt Berlin, dann werden 2 bis 3 Mann von euch hochgehen. Und ich denke, man wird sich ein bisschen mit einem Scharfschützengewehr auf die Lauer legen.
Ja, was sind Sie denn überhaupt?
Mirke sagt, unser Schwert ist ein scharfes Schwert. Nur, es wird zurückgeschlagen, Herr.
Ja, wer sind Sie denn?
Tschüss.
That's the quote. And I have to tell you, in the description of this particular voice was the word intellectual. The sound, the voice had to sound intellectual. Now, I have many German colleagues, and they all sound intellectual, so I had a big choice. But the ones who actually did this were Jens Lackmund and Giselle Bosse. And now you get to see, the actual oral analysis by the Stasi. For instance, if you the first row, you see Tonhöhe, that is pitch, and the description is tief, sehr tief, deep to very deep. You see something like sound color, dunkel, kehlig, gedeckt means dark, throaty, covered. And the speech style, Sprechstil, is, as I said, intellectual, pertinent, mostly monological. But the tension, the Spannungsgrad, was by and large relaxed. This is an interesting combination in itself, actually. This was a description. So what they did is they made this kind of descriptions. They put it in the archive. So they had a large archive of these descriptions, also of the tapes. And if a new person would a new phone call would be or a new situation would be recorded, they would try to make a new description and then compare those descriptions. And you can imagine that wasn't easy. But there was also something else that was very specific. As I said, this type of analysis was not dissimilar to, for instance, US audio forensics, because I already explained that the mechanical visual inspection, the voice print was contested there. Yet, what was the difference between the US and the GDR? That in the US, they would select suspects after the crime and then doing the analysis for a limited person of suspects. But the Stasi built an archive of voices a priori, so for potential future suspects, which implied doing a high number of comparisons. In case of the example we just listened to, the comparisons had to be made with all male, deeply sounding, intellectually sounding voices the Stasi had in stock. And starting out from future suspects actually expressed this totalitarian embedding of the voice archive. Moreover, matching required that there was sufficient overlap, and this was also very important, sufficient overlap between the words, phrases, and emotions used in the newly captured and in the archive speech. And to create the overlap, Stasi officers elicited a rich oral collection of speech. The officers receiving anonymous telephone calls, for instance, had to keep the people as long as possible on the line by saying things like, "Please repeat this once more, I cannot hear you," or by slowing down and distracting the callers so that they would forget using a twisted voice. And in addition, they had to notate all background sounds, like people running up and down the staircase, the sounds of traffic or household equipment, you know, like the ones mentioned here, trams, refrigerators, coffee machines, etc., to locate where someone was calling from. And another strategy was having Stasi agents pretend they were telephone company employees servicing the line, chatting with future suspects and steering the conversation in such a way that the suspect would utter a rich variety of expressions and emotions. So, for instance, they would try to get the people angry, so that they had, so they had the angry version of the voice as well already on tape, just in case. Or they invited suspects to the Stasi studios, interviewing them and forcing them by surprise to read a particular text aloud. Both the secret recordings at the citizens' homes and those in the Stasi studios had to be made with similar equipment as used in wiretapping and eavesdropping, and also in similar acoustic settings. And Stasi officers, and this was one of the surprising findings, Stasi officers were explicitly instructed not to use a higher quality equipment in the studios than in, for instance, telephone booths, because otherwise the comparison would be destroyed. In addition, testing the acoustic qualities of the recorded space was seen as very important. Officers had to test the reverberation of the recorded space, for instance, by clapping their hands, and reducing the reverberation by adding, if possible, something like curtains. So here again, the acoustic situation in the studio and acoustic situation in the recorded space had to be as closely together, as similar as possible. Well, notwithstanding all this work, the Stasi was not very enthusiastic about its rate of success. In the mid-1970s, the identification rate was 20%, with the Stasi not only able to enhance, which the Stasi was only able to enhance by what they called political operative knowledge. And the number of hits in the matching exercises themselves was very low. It was 4.3% in 1984 and 70% in 1987, and they had to do thousands of comparisons per year. It was about 3,000 per year in the late 1980s, and each report involved 20 pages, about 20 pages of text. This gives an idea of the listening situation. This is a famous picture. The Stasi itself listed several causes for these low identification rates. One thing was that expert oral analysis was very time-consuming, especially in case of deliberately distorted tapes. That the verbalization of sound lacked standardization. Stasi experts might not use the same words for the same sounds or recognize other people's descriptions, and the retrieval of large amounts of recordings and transcripts was complex. And this implied that what had initially been an advantage for the Stasi, namely collecting suspect voices a priori and eliciting a rich collection of sound, was a downside in practice. An additional problem was the incredibly detailed system used to classify the recordings, which included information about the misdemeanors recorded as well as the characteristics of the voice, from the gender and the assumed age of the speaker to the many characteristics of voice. And the classification manual was about 200 pages at the end of the 80s, just only the classification, right? So people had to tick the box and say, okay, this is a male, this is the kind of crime, this is the sound, etc. And the Stasi tried to simplify this several times, but this reduced the consistency over time. Stasi officials tried to find solutions in establishing intersubjectivity and standardization. They did the first by underlining the usefulness of what they called the hearing collective. And this seemed to refer to the idea of collectively listening and understanding each other's verbalization, although, to be fair, I've only found a few references to this idea of a hearing collective. And standardization of the verbalization of sound was attempted by using the method of semantic differential. And the Stasi documents do not literally mention this term, but we can deduce it from comparing an oral analysis report from 1975, our earlier example, with a form used in 1982. And as you can see, it changed from an open description to a closed, prescribed sort of multiple choice one. I will need the 5 minutes. Here you can see the semantic differential. It refers to describing subjective experiences in terms of prescribed bipolar notions, like what we see on the screen, weak, strong, big, small, or not on the screen, for instance, for the psychological character of the speaker, arrogant, modest, and civilized, primitive. This was one of these kind of opposition that was often used, arrogant, modest, and civilized, primitive. Now, such issues of finding words for sound, communicating about sound across individuals, mapping sound to something else, were not only the Stasi problems. It is part and parcel of the sonic skills doctors and engineers and scientists apply when using sound and listening to acquire knowledge about bodies, machines, and other objects of research. This is what we study in the Maastricht Sonic Skills Project, and on the photos you see the team members from left to right, Stefan Kraves, Yuri Breinings, Anna Harris, Melissa van Drie, and Alexander Super. What we ask in the project is how doctors, engineers, and scientists used sonic skills to make sense of what they studied, what kind of knowledge they generated by doing this, and why it often remained contested nonetheless. And we focus on the 1920s and after, and on areas in which sound was not the object of study, but the means to acquire knowledge. So not acoustics and audiology, but medicine, engineering, and sciences like ornithology. It will become clear in a minute why I tell you this. On the image, you see medical students collectively listening with stethoscopes. It's a picture from the 1920s. You see an engineer listening in a white coat, like a doctor, with a listening rod to a car engine. This is a picture from the 1960s. And you see ornithologists using a parabolic reflector for recording bird sound. This is a picture from the 1930s. And with sonic skills, we do not only refer to listening modes, but also to the techniques linked to the proper use of equipment for listening, but also for recording, storing, and retrieving sound. And these sonic skills have often co-defined the object of analysis and the knowledge resulting from it. Yuri Breinings, for instance, has shown that ornithologists using parabolic microphones, which help to direct the sound of birds, aimed for a very clean sonic image of birds without interference of environmental noise. This helped them to carefully distinguish different species and bird calls on the basis of very small differences in bird sound. It took years, however, before ornithologists came to acknowledge that birds might actually change their song in response to environmental noise. So this was, here you see that, yeah, the instrument and the particular use of the sonic skills attached to these instruments, kind of listening, define the kind of knowledge you can get out of listening, and also in fact they define your object. Now, what is relevant for understanding the story of the Stasi is that sonic skills acquired a different status in particular strands of medicine and engineering mechanics than in the sciences like ornithology. While manual oral analysis remained relatively important in medical professions and in the guild-like trades such as German car mechanics, ornithologists increasingly choose for mechanical visual analysis or sonograms for studying bird sounds in the 1950s and after. And in the Sonic Skills Project, we claim that there is a relationship between the acceptability of expert listening and embodied knowledge in and professional settings, in which a tacit knowledge is usually linked to a well-defined jurisdiction and a certain level of secrecy. In contrast, the sciences have often argued for mobile knowledge, distributed analysis, standardized skills, organized distrust, and an open system of data sharing. Inscriptions such as sonograms enact such ideals of mobile knowledge. The Stasi, however, hesitated between embodied and mobile knowledge, which expressed, as I said, its totalitarian embedding. It preferred manual oral analysis within the matching logic of mechanical visual analysis, the fingerprint, but without the common forensic practice of suspect selection after the crime. It developed the notion of the hearing collective and started to use the semantic differential to cope with the lack of standardization and distribution of knowledge, while it kept building on expert listening and tacit skills. And let us remind that they did this because they had to deal with distortion, itself the result of suppression. So they had to listen through the distortion, so to say. So the expert listening, the embodied forms of listening, were necessary as a consequence of the suppression that caused the distortion of the tapes in the first place. Now, one would expect of a Ministry of State Security that it, of course, treasured secrecy and its own jurisdiction at the expense of data sharing. In case of the Stasi and the GDR government, however, data sharing happened not even to be the practice within its organization, because they find out at the end of the existence of the Stasi almost, so by the end of the 1980s, they found out that there was not one Stimmarchiv, but there were several Stimmarchives. Not only the Parkment 26 had an archive, but also the Ministry of Inner Affairs, and also the so-called Hauptabteilung of the Stasi. And this was a complete surprise for Abteilung 26 itself. They didn't know about it, and it had consequences. Not only did they have different criteria for how to select people for a prior recording, but they may also have recorded the same people more than once, undermining the Stasi's own effectivity. This is why my time is up, but this is also the conclusion. And what the tapestry actually is a detail from a tapestry for kids that showed the activities of kids during the day and also what their parents did during the day. And several of these elements of this tapestry actually referred to the sonic skills of their parents, so to say. And I would like to end that this story might provide a bit of comfort for those who worry about the National Security Agency in the US and our privacy. First of all, secret agencies have much to fear from the enemy within. And second, comprehensive systems have a high chance of running ashore in their own details. Thank you.